guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant?
Dare to think out loud.
You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded.
Dare to think out loud.
You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren.
Dare to think out loud.
You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history.
Dare to think out loud.
You have tuned in to the right show.
Dare to think out loud.
Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Oh, well, thank you, Giuseppe, for that great introduction. And folks, welcome to our program, which is today we're calling it Addicted to Our Own Destruction. And it goes right along with Dare to Think Out Loud. And we today are going to dispense with a lot of our normal yak so that we can get our distinguished guest on today to get as much from him as we possibly can, because he has a treasure trove of information. Now, we've got the producer, Dave Scorpio, with us. My regular Cal Robbins is also here, along with DW. But the focus today is Parson Ted Weiland. And he is just a plethora of information, and his message is just so strong. So I'm going to quit yakking. Pastor Parson, I'm sorry, would you give us a little bit of your background and tell us from whence you come, sir?
Well, first of all, let me thank you guys for having me on. For obvious reasons, as we get into this, I'm not the most popular guy with a lot of the quote-unquote patriot community, and even with a lot of Christians and their involvement from the same standpoint that the patriot community is coming from. So I appreciate you guys allowing me to be on your program and to hopefully get the message out that I feel is absolutely dire for the salvation of our nation. If you're concerned with saving America from the precipice that she precipitously teeters upon right now, I believe that what we're going to be talking about is key and foundational to us being able to do that. So thank you, guys. I appreciate it very much. As far as me, you know, the way I like to introduce myself is from 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And by the way, this is my passage. It belongs to me. Now, I'll let you guys borrow it, but it's mine. It's where Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where he says, in verse 26, he says, "For see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men are after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. The base things of the world and the things which are despised has God chosen, yea, the things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. And then it ends in the next, in the last verse, verse 31, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. You know, when Christ, when God first touched my life with the gospel of Christ, with his blood atoning death and burial and resurrection, and all that it meant, I was nothing but a dumb tobacco spit and cussing bull rider. And I may be, want to be careful about saying that. People may think, well, if you were so dumb to ride bulls, I don't know if I want to, I don't know if I want to listen to you. But let's go back to 1 Corinthians 1. That's, you know, I was one of those, just like the dumb fishermen he chose in the first century and some of you other guys. So that's who Ted Weiland is. You know, anything that may be honorable in what people see in me now is simply Christ. Why he chose me, I have no idea, but that's who I am. I've been a pastor for over 40 years and dedicated to the gospel of Christ and his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we could have Ted just back off your mic just a little bit, because sometimes you're when you're talking, you're overloading the mic a little bit. So if you could just pull the mic back just a little bit from where you're speaking, and I think we'll get a little better audio.
Okay, let me interruption. No problem. What I'm going to have to do is back off from, and you let me know when I'm far enough back. I could not come up with the headphones with my mic, so we're working straight off the computer mic. So is I backed off some. Is that any better?
Yeah, that sounds much better. Okay.
Okay. I will, and I may have a tendency to move forward. So if I do so, Dave, just let me know.
Okay, great.
Anyway, that's Ted Weiland. So that's the best I can give you. I am thrilled to know my God, my Lord and Savior, and I'm not worthy of it, but by his grace, any of us are here by and only his grace and his choice of us to serve him.
Well, Parson, that is fantastic. The one thing I think that the folks would like to hear is you have just a fantastic book out there. Would you tell the people how that book came about and your purpose in doing so? And tell us about the book, please.
And I take it that you're referring to Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, the Christian Perspective.
Yes, sir.
And that particular book is devoted to, obviously, what the title says, the Bible law, not with or for, but Bible law versus the United States Constitution. And there's a chapter in that book devoted, once you get to chapter 3, beginning with the preamble, there's a chapter devoted to every article and amendment found in the Constitution. And we don't just look at it in comparison, we actually examine the Constitution by the Bible. And the reason you asked, you know, how did I come to write that book? It really finds probably its genesis in what David wrote to us in Psalms 19, where in Psalms 19, 7 through 11, we find the following. It says, the law of Yahweh, and I've reinserted his Hebrew name where it belongs, where he inspired it. So instead of the Lord in caps, I've put in Yahweh. And it says, the law of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of Yahweh is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of Yahweh are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of Yahweh is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of Yahweh is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of Yahweh are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned, and in keeping them, there is a great reward. Now, why with that available to us, with that law, the perfect law, and all that's described therein, and there's much more to it than even what's found in those few verses, why would anybody want even what most people claim, I don't believe it's true, but what most people claim is man's best attempt at providing government for mankind, why would we want man's fickle, finite man's fickle attempt at producing, even if it is the best that man has ever come up with, when we can have God's perfect law and its government instead. I don't understand that. And so I knew when I came to understand, I came from a position where most of Christianity, also known as churchianity in many cases, came from, and that was that the law was no longer relevant under the new covenant. When I came to understand how relevant it really is, not for justification, only Christ's blood can justify us as individuals, but as the means or the standard by which we're to conduct our lives individually as families and as communities and as governments of those communities, I realized that, wait a minute, there's something wrong here if we're promoting the Constitution as the supreme law. And I would suggest that people consider what that really means. Idolatry is not so much about statues as it is statutes with a T. Such as what one considers, promotes, or swears to as a supreme law of the land. And there can only be one supreme law. You know, it's either the Constitution per Article 6, or it's God's triune moral law, his commandments, statutes, and judgments per the Bible. And to try to meld the two, to try to meld the Bible and what I emphatically... And what I believe the book that I just mentioned proves is that to try to meld the Bible and God's laws with the biblically seditious Constitution is to be as double-minded as were the Israelites with Elijah on Mount Carmel, where he said, "Why halt you between two opinions?" And I'm going to say it this way: if we the people, which is just a contemporary form of Baal, be God, serve them. But if Yahweh be God, serve him. And if you're familiar with the story on Mount Carmel, you know what came of that situation. And thankfully, the people, it may have been short-lived, but the people after God revealed his power and Elijah was done, they cried out, "Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God." They rejected Baal, at least momentarily there. And again, Baal is just an ancient form of we the peopleism, which I address in the book and in some of my other books and articles as well. So that was the impetus for the book, Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective, which, by the way, your audience can find the entire book. They don't have to buy the book. All of my books, except for one or two of them, can be found at our website free of charge. We have an online book and article page, and that entire 575-page book can be found there on. And let me also mention, by the way, that web page is Bible Versus, that's Versus spelled out, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution.org. So Bible Versus Constitution.org. Go to our online book page and you can find that book and several other of my books online for you can download it on your own. But also let me point out that in the right-hand sidebar, you'll also find a 10 question Constitution survey. And if your audience will take that survey, I will provide them a free copy of the hardback primer, which is 85 pages of the big book, Bible Law versus Constitution, free of charge, along with some CDs, some messages, and some other goodies as well. So I pay the postage, I pay everything free of charge. If they'll go and take the survey, that way I'll have their address and know where to send it to. So that's available to your audience as well. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I get busy listening and I forget I'm supposed to say something. Pardon me for that. I have one of the questions that struck me, sir, about 25, 30 years ago. And that was this: is in reading Benjamin Franklin's biography, And he talked about the Constitutional Convention, and he was the one about 2 months into the proceedings who introduced the idea that maybe they should start their each day out with prayer. And he made a motion to that effect, and this is all recorded in National Archives. He made a motion that they start the proceedings with prayer. He said, we're not getting anywhere with this, and we're having too much disunion, too much discord. We should at least do like we did in the First Continental Congress and start the day off with prayer. He got a second on that motion, but then there was a protest from Alexander Hamilton, who said, we don't want the public to think that we are having that kind of problem here, and calling in a minister for prayer would so indicate. And he even went so far as to say he didn't want to turn the proceedings over to a foreign power, which I found very telling. And then in his biography, again, Benjamin Franklin says that of all of the people there, he thought that there was probably less than three or four in attendance who thought prayers necessary. So that was very telling to me back then. And then the question immediately popped into my mind was, how could a group of people who are non-believers come up with a Christian document to start with?
Yeah, excellent point. In fact, you'll find all that you just said, your audience can find in chapter three, and everything in the book, in the Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, is also documented. So Franklin wrote, like you said, I'll give you the exact quote. He said, the convention, except three or four persons, thought prayers unnecessary, end of quote. And that came out of his own diary concerning the Constitutional Convention. And that's documented. There'll be a link there that they can go straight to the documentation if they want that, as well as documentation on everything else I quote in the book. So, yeah, great question. How could these guys that weren't even concerned about praying? And by the way, that's the rest of the story. That's the rest of the story that, I lost his name. Who did the rest of the story?
Oh, no. Go ahead, guys.
Paul Harvey, of course. This was a rest of the story, probably more important than any rest of the story Paul Harvey ever told. This is one he should have told.
Because Ted, if I can get you to back off your mic a little bit, to overload your mic a little bit again.
Okay. Thank you. This is the rest of the story he should have told and never did, that I'm aware of course, and I doubt that he ever did. He'd have probably been taken off the radio had he done so. But and the reason it's important is because you hear Christians all the time mentioning only the first half of what Benjamin Franklin did. He did propose, quote, prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings upon the deliberations be held in this assembly. He did propose that, but they never tell the rest of the story. And that is that it didn't get anywhere, and that they didn't pray, and that they weren't concerned about praying, and they were never concerned about the Constitution they were creating being harmonious with God's law. And that's the rest of the story about the Constitution, because Christians out there have been hoodwinked into believing that this is a biblically compatible document when it's anything but biblically compatible. There's hardly an article or amendment that's not antithetical, if not seditious, to Yahweh's sovereignty and his morality. I appreciate you bringing that up, Michael, because people are just not aware of the rest of the story when it comes to Benjamin Franklin and what he proposed for prayers.
Exactly.
He was one of the least likely to do so. Now, I don't know that he was a deist at that time, but he, you know, and actually the framers and the majority of the founding fathers are often misidentified as deists. They were not deists, except for Benjamin Franklin, at least at one point in his life. Most of them, the majority of them, were not deists in the purest sense of the word, but they were also not Christians in the biblical sense of the word. The best description for them, they were theistic rationalists, a combination or meld of the two. And Franklin was probably the least likely. He didn't claim to be a Christian. And yet he was the one that came up with prayer. And where, what does that say about the rest of them when they said no way? And what's it say about the Constitution they formed, just like you pointed out, Michael?
Exactly, sir. And one of my other points, and I would like for you to address this, if you would, is that in the early 80s, I had the good fortune to be at the National Archives, Library of Congress, and other stuff, researching extensively for the position I held in the intelligence community at the time. But I, being a history nut, so to speak, I wanted to look at an awful lot of source documents that were available at those locations. And so in reading thousands of letters between the people we call framers or founders, and there are thousands of letters, there's over 1,200 letters between Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. So there are thousands of letters that were available at the time. And of course, back then I had to read them all on microfiche. But I remember in reading in those letters, and I found it very interesting that among the founders or framers, the person that they said was the most devout Christian among them was Patrick Henry. Well, Patrick Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention because he said he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia. And then no one fought harder against the ratification of the Constitution than Patrick Henry. Parson, have you ever heard anyone explain why that the most devout Christian among them opposed the Constitution?
Well, that's one of my favorite quotes from Patrick Henry, and if for no other reason than he is the hero of so many patriots. But once again, they have not been told, or they've ignored the rest of the story concerning Patrick Henry. I am confident the vast majority of constitutionalists, whether it be patriots or Christian constitutionalists, alleged, the vast majority of them do not have never heard that Patrick Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention as one of Virginia's delegates. And like you said, that he said, "I smelt a rat." Let me give you a quote from his. He spoke numerous times at the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1788, spoke adamantly against the Constitution. And let me just give you a small segment so that people can see where he was coming from on this. And this is also, by the way, found in Chapter 3, which is the preamble, "We the People versus Yahweh." That's the title of that chapter. And in that chapter, they can scroll down to where I mentioned Patrick Henry, and convinced that the Constitution would fail, this is his position, fail to secure and protect liberty, Patrick Henry voiced his concerns again to the Virginia Ratifying Convention. Here's what, just a very small portion of what he says. You know, about the only thing most people know about Patrick Henry is his "Give Me Liberty" speech, which was back, of course, near or during the time of 1776. But listen to this. This is what people just don't know about Patrick Henry, the one who was closely, if not, he was certainly the closest to being a Christian. Here's what he said, quote, "I say our privileges and rights are in danger. The new form of government will effectually oppress and ruin the people. In some parts of the plan before you, the great rights of freemen are endangered, and in other parts, absolutely taken away. There will be no checks, no real balances in this government. What can avail your spacious imaginary balances, your rope dancing, chain rattling, ridiculous ideal checks and contrivances? And yet who knows the danger that this new system may produce? They are out of sight of the common people. They cannot foresee latent consequences. I see great jeopardy in this new government," end of quote. And in contrast to the Federalist failed predictions about the Constitution, this and nearly everything the Anti-Federalist forecast about the Constitution has come true even after the Bill of Rights was added. I mean, it was like what I just read to you is like prophecy of where we find ourselves today. And by the way, a lot of people will come back with what I'm saying here and in other ways in the book and say, well, it wasn't the Constitution's fault. It wasn't the constitutional framers' fault. It's the renegade judges and legislators and sometimes presidents that are the problem. It's not the Constitution. Well, sorry, folks, it still goes right back to the Constitution. How do you think we ended up with the caliber of civil leaders we have today? I mean, that should be a question everybody is asking. You know, not just focusing on who and what they're doing today, but how did we ever end up with them in the first place? Do you think it might go back to Article 6, Christian test ban, by which, and this is where it's really important, by which mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders were eliminated? You know, when you eliminate God's mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders, for example, like what's found in Exodus 18:21, that part of which requires the fear of Yahweh, you end up with nothing. You eliminate that alone. You know, David and Solomon, King David and Solomon both said that wisdom, understanding, knowledge all come from or begin with the fear of Yahweh. Therefore, you eliminate the fear of Yahweh, that just that one mandatory qualification for civil leaders, and you're going to end up with nincompoops. We got a lot of nincompoops today. We also have scoundrels. We have immoral reprobates and outright criminals. Why? Doing what they do, they've made the Constitution much worse, you know, or at least the results thereof much worse. We're reaping the whirlwind that the Constitution framers, from the wind the Constitution framers sowed back in 1787. The whirlwind has gotten much worse, and it's going to continue to get worse until we figure out what the genesis of this is, what the wind that created. And ironically, a lot of people are trying to go back to the wind, trying to appeal to the wind that created the whirlwind as the answer. It's the genesis, not the solution, of why we find ourselves in America where we are today. And so I'm not sure I answered your question exactly. I kind of forget what it was, but that's my take on, or at least that's what I provide from Patrick Henry, that most people simply are unaware of, that came from this hero of theirs.
Well, very well done, sir. You did answer the question, but you prompted another point that I want to place before you, and you touched on it. In 1787, 12 of the 13 states had within their state constitution an oath to the Christian faith. 12 of 13. The only state that did not have that within their state constitution was Rhode Island. Rhode Island sent no delegates to the Constitutional Convention. So every delegate at the Constitutional Convention, when it opened in May and went through September of 1787, every delegate there was coming from a state that had a Christian oath before you could hold public office. Well, with Article 6, Clause 3, they did away with that oath. And here's the question I've asked people when I give my presentations is, when can you imagine a group of people who have gone to a convention to create a document and all of them are operating under an oath to the Christian faith and they decide to leave it out of the Constitution they create? And then, sir, are you familiar with a delegate to the North Carolina Ratification Convention by the name of Henry Abbott?
I'm not intimately familiar with him, but yes, I do know of it.
Okay, well, Henry Abbott made a statement at the North Carolina Ratification Convention, which I felt was just spellbinding, and he said, people, if we adopt this Constitution with Article 6, Clause 3, if we eliminate the oath to the Christian faith, there will come a time in the American government to where our government is filled with non-believers, infidels, and Muslims.
Yeah, actually, I quote Abbott, and that's about all that I do. That's the only one I remember quoting Abbott, but they'll find that quote and its documentation in, that'd be chapter 9, dealing with Article 6. Chapter 9 is entitled Article 6, the Supreme Law of the Land. And if they'll go down, scroll down to the heading regarding the test oaths, they'll find that specific quotation that you just referred to there, Michael. And, you know, and that's a good, and that's an excellent point. You know, you try to find common ground with people, and there's very few patriots and Christians today who aren't rightfully concerned with the fact that America's landscape has been dotted with mosques devoted to the quote-unquote God Allah, from which, among other things, our posterity is being proselytized to their false religion. At least some of them are, and some of them will be. So we're all rightfully concerned with that. But nobody, it seems like, or very few people, you guys are an exception, but very few people have said, well, how did this come to be? You know, I ask people, is America's landscape dotted not only with mosques, but with temples and synagogues devoted to gods, not Yahweh, which takes us right back to the first commandment. Is it because of the first commandment that those are here, or is it because of the First Amendment that enabled all of these religions to stand equally here in America to do their dirty work, the worst of which is the proselytization of our posterity to their false gods? You know, and what's really ironic about this is that probably more than any other component of the entire Constitution and the Bill of Rights that Christians hang their hat on more than anything else, it's the First Amendment. Not realizing, and they talk about, we got to have freedom of religion. Well, what they don't realize is that freedom of religion and Christian liberty are not the same thing. In fact, Christian liberty was sacrificed on the altar of the freedom of religion when Amendment 1 and its free exercise clause was adopted, allowing all of these other religions and their false gods to find ground and to do what they do here in America. And so it's a real, I mean, it just illustrates how hoodwinked our people have been. And regrettably, it's Christian pastors and ministry leaders that are at the head of this brain dirtying regarding the Constitution. And it needs to be exposed. And that's why I wrote the book, you know, Ephesians 5:11, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead expose them. And I took it to heart, and I wrote the book. And I would mention again, for somebody who's maybe just joining us, be sure to take that 10-question Constitution survey in the right-hand column at BibleVersusConstitution.org, and you'll get a free copy of the 85-page primer of the big book. In fact, you let me know you want the free book, or the entire book. And if you can't afford to send a donation, I don't care. I'll send you the free book free of charge, the entire book, the free of charge as well. And again, everything's also found on our website, on our online book and article page.
Well, that's most gracious, Parson. That is just fantastic. People, you have no excuse if you do not want to see the truth and to examine the wonderful work there by Parson Weiland. And Parson, there's a question that I asked yesterday on a program out of Ohio, and we were talking about the Constitution. My question was, if there was anyone in the group
you're breaking up, Michael. Can you try that again?
Okay. Yesterday, I was on a program in Ohio, and I had a question to the group, and we were discussing the Constitution and the validity of the Constitution. And in that question, my question was, if anyone in the group could name a Christian who was actually in attendance at the Constitutional Convention. Have you ever addressed that subject, sir?
Not in that specific fashion, other than to point out, again, as I mentioned earlier, that these guys were neither deists in the purest sense of the word nor Christians in the biblical sense of the word. Well, I do address, come to think of it, in, I believe it's chapter 5, executive usurpation, dealing with Article 2. I do deal with the fact that many of these men were Freemasons. George Washington, in fact, swore his, or at his inauguration, swore allegiance to the Constitution wearing the apron of a Freemason on a Bible that came out of the Masonry temple. So I do have some information concerning their Masonic connections, but I don't go into their non-Christian the non-Christian aspect of these men in any great detail, because I'm really dealing more with the Constitution than the men themselves. Now, I would recommend that people get a book. I'm trying to grab it here, hang on. A book, it's entitled, I can't reach it with my earphones, but it's a book by Dr. Greg Fraser, and he deals with the religious founders, or excuse me, the founders, the 18th century founding fathers, including the constitutional framers, religious persuasions, and he is one of the first guys I've ever seen dealing with them that doesn't cherry pick these guys, and he proves by their quotations themselves, and anybody who reads my books is going to find lots of quotations by these guys, and they can determine this on their own without even Dr. Fraser. But anyway, he has a book devoted to showing that these guys were, again, neither deist or, yeah, deist in the purest sense of the word, nor Christians in the biblical sense of the word. So his is one. In fact, if you'll go online and Google Dr. Albert Mohler's interview with Dr. Fraser, you're going to come up with a great interview where he interviews Dr. Fraser, who, by the way, is at least was at the time of this interview, I'm not sure he still is, but was the professor of history at the Master's College in California. And anyway, it's a great interview. I think it's only an hour long. You can start with that. And it was hearing that interview with Dr. Fraser that prompted me to get his book. Now, I would have carried his book on our list, except for, regrettably, what he does with Romans 13. And I just couldn't put it out there with what he does with Romans 13. But otherwise, I highly recommend the book, because he doesn't cherry pick the guys and he really shows what they really are. So I would suggest, rather than, you know, I don't have a lot of information in my book concerning their religious persuasions per se, but Dr. Fraser's book certainly does.
Hey, well, thank you for that, sir. Another question I would ask you, and for the people listening, do you at any point in time address those people we call founders who left the Constitutional Convention many times in disgust?
Yeah, of course, Patrick Henry, who even refused to even attend. I also deal with Luther Martin. There's quotes of his. And I think there's one or two others who I might deal with as well. But definitely Luther Martin's, some of his quotations at the, I'm thinking his, I think he was Maryland, if I remember correctly.
You're correct, sir.
Okay,
you're
Maryland, correct. Yeah. At the Maryland convention, state ratifying convention, he, like Patrick Henry at the Virginia ratifying convention, spoke out against the Constitution. And he was one that, he was there as a delegate, and in disgust, he left the convention and then stood against it at the conventions. And regrettably, neither Henry nor Luther Martin were able to convince the conventions not to ratify this document known as the United States Constitution. Now, I will say this about those guys is that theirs wasn't necessarily, their arguments against the Constitution were not necessarily from a biblical paradigm. And that's where I'm approaching it from. That's the standard. There's only one ethical standard by which everything, including the Constitution and the framers, is to be ethically evaluated, and that's by our God and Creator's law, is the Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments. That's the ethical standard by which everything is to be examined. Now, these guys came up with the right conclusion without even doing that. But my book is devoted to examining it by that standard. That is the standard, and that's what we want to return to. And I would add, I want to make sure that I add this, that you had mentioned, Michael, the 12 state constitutions that had a Christian test oath in it. That was eliminated eventually even in the state constitutions via Article 6 of the federal constitution. But I think it's only right that I also point out that the Christian test oaths were even in those state constitutions extremely weak and could be, faked by someone and say, yeah, I'll take the Christian test oath with no intentions of ever doing so. What's really important about Article 6 Christian test ban is that in so doing that, which the state constitutions did not have, it eliminates the mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders. And even the state constitutions, albeit better than the federal constitution, which came 11 years later, after the declaration or after the war for quote unquote independence, better than the federal constitution, they were still very inundated with Enlightenment thinking and the sovereignty of man, and they were better, but they were still not anywhere what they should have been. If we want to go back to the true biblical Christian foundations of this country, we need to go back to the early 1600s. Rather than the late 1700s, even to the state constitutions. In fact, let me if we've got time, it won't take long, but I'm sure we have time to do this. Let me read to you from the Fundamental Agreement of the Colony of New Haven, Connecticut, 1639. This is just a small portion of it, but it'll give the flavor to your audience, and especially highlight the differences between what the constitutions of not all of them, but some of the constitutions of the early 1600s and the federal constitution that people today, how they do it, I don't know, claim that it's a biblical and Christian document, and even the state constitutions of the same time. So listen to this. This is the Fundamental Agreement of the Colony of New Haven, Connecticut, 1639, quote, agreement. We all agree that the scriptures hold forth a perfect rule for the direction and government of all men in duties which they are to perform to God and to man, as well as in families and commonwealth, as in the matters of the church. So likewise in all public officers which concern civil orders, as choice of magistrates and officers, making and repealing laws, dividing allotments of inheritance, and all things of like nature, we will, all of us, be ordered by the rules which the scriptures hold forth. And we agree that such persons may be entrusted with such matters of government as are described in Exodus 18:21, Deuteronomy 1:13, with Deuteronomy 17:15, and 1 Corinthians 6:1, 6, and 7. That's just a small portion of it, but you can, if you want to find our biblical foundations, there you have it. Back in the early 1600s, when they didn't form governments of, by, and for the people. I mean, think about that, people. Of, by, and for the people? That's humanism. That's man doing what is right in his own eyes per Judges 21:25. what is commonly known as secular humanism, aka I say we the peopleism. You know, you talk about humanism and peopleism, it's not, there ain't much difference except in the spelling of the words. What they did back in the early 1600s was formed governments of, by, and for God, expressly established upon his perfect law of liberty, his Ten Commandments, and their respective statutes that explain them and the judgments that enforce them. And that's the reason why America became great or blessed by God. Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14. There we find when men look to, with their governments, to God as their sovereign, and thus his laws as supreme, he provides in those first opening verses, the blessings that come from having done so. The remaining verses in that chapter provide the curses for when we don't make God our sovereign over our nation and our government and ourselves and his laws, his moral laws as supreme of the land. If you want to find, you know, Trump, there's no way that Trump can make America great again. Particularly since he has himself sworn to the biblically seditious Constitution as the supreme law of the land. He only helps perpetuate what was begun in 1787. If you want to make America great again, let me go back a minute here. Only God, not Trump, only God can make America great again. And he will only do so for the same reasons he made America great in the first place. And that's found in such documents as I just read to you from the New Haven, Connecticut Agreement. And that's, by the way, that's what I just read to you is also in Chapter 3, the preamble, We the People versus the United States Constitution in the Big Book or online on our online book page.
Well, very well done, sir, and very well addressed. There's another subject I would like for us to approach here with the Constitution, and I want to go back to the aforementioned Luther Martin and that saying. And what I would like for you to address is the Constitution of 1787, which embraced the institution of slavery. And it was written into a constitution, although they didn't use the name slavery, people held a service. But the remark at the Constitutional Convention by Luther Martin is most telling, and I would like your response to that. And he said, and I quote, "The revolution was grounded in defense of the natural, God-given rights possessed by all mankind. But the Constitution was an insult to that God, who views with equal eye the poor African slave and his American slave master," unquote. Your thoughts on that, sir?
I'm not real familiar with that quote, but I do address I'm looking for it here right now, I believe it's chapter 22, where chapter 22, amendment 13, Constitution versus biblical slavery. And again, you need to keep in mind that my paradigm is God's law. And God's law provides for slavery, three different types of slavery, in fact. But it's a far different kind of slavery than what, of course, was here in America. And in fact, what we had with the black slavery in early America was itself a violation of God's law of kidnapping. And that is not allowed. And but there is other types of slavery. In fact, the entire, one of those being the entire judicial, let me put it this way, criminal justice system under the criminal justice system that the framers provided, because they eliminated God's law as the basis for it, is a criminal justice system with the word criminal all in caps. Whereas that contrasted with the Bible's criminal justice system with justice all in caps. And that system, well, let's go back to the criminal justice system of the United States Constitution that provides for prisons. Prisons are superfluous under God's system. And talk about injustice, where the prisons, the Constitutional Republic's prison system, which is a form of slavery, by the way, is paid for by who? By innocent taxpayers, oftentimes the victims themselves of the criminals who get incarcerated through the criminal taxing system, also under provided through the Constitutional Republic. Why should you, if you're a taxpayer, pay for somebody's housing, clothing, food, and entertainment for whatever years they're incarcerated? Why should somebody who's innocent have to pay for a criminal's upkeep? Under God's system, there are no prisons. Capital criminals, capital crime, as only God can and has the authority to determine, when a convicted capital criminal is put to death immediately after conviction. He doesn't have to go to prison. He's done. He's gone, with its deterrent effect upon anybody who wants to commit the same crime in the future. And non-capital criminals, such as thieves, are required to pay 2 to 5 times restitution, not to the government, but to their victims, depending upon the nature of the crime, 2 to 5 times restitution. If they can't pay restitution, what do you do with them then? Somebody's going to ask. Well, you don't put them in prison according to God's law. You put them in indentured servitude, where they work off their debt, and their victims still get paid. And somebody will come back and they'll say, well, but what if they don't want to pay restitution? Well, guess what? God's law then says that's contempt of court, which is really contempt of Yahweh and his laws, which becomes a capital criminal. And unless a thief has a death wish, he's going to pay restitution. And if he has to, even if it means having to go into indentured servitude to do so. Now, where was I going with that? Slavery. One of the means of slavery is indentured servitude under God's law. That you want to be a thief, then get ready, if you're caught, to become a slave, an indentured servant, as for the length of time required to pay off 2 to 5 times restitution to your victims. They'll find that again. That's in chapter 22, Amendment 12. Amendment 13. Constitutional versus biblical slavery. Dave's got me so far away from my computer screen, I'm having a hard time reading it, but it's more important that you guys can understand me, of course. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Mike, you're muted.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you addressing that, sir. I too was far away from my screen and couldn't see I had muted myself. That is... one of the points that I wanted you to address was that that address by Luther Martin I thought was most prescient. And also, George Mason at the Constitutional Convention stood very strongly against slavery, even though he was a slave owner. But the other point that I would like to make and to get into, of course, we may run out of time in the first hour to get to this, but you've mentioned a couple of times the Bill of Rights. And people so many times erroneously believe that the Bill of Rights actually amended the Constitution. And there is a plethora of evidence out there that indicates that was exactly the opposite, that the Bill of Rights did little to nothing to stop the effects of a tyrannical government. But before we get to the top of the hour, sir, are you familiar with Samuel Bryan?
That name does not ring a bell with me.
Samuel Bryan wrote as an anti-federalist under the name Sentinel.
Okay.
And very early on, Samuel Bryan said that the Constitutional Convention was in fact a criminal conspiracy, which the Federalists would wrap in the cloak of divinity. And I found that to be a most relevant comment from someone just 2 months after the Constitutional Convention was over. Samuel Bryan wrote 24 essays, very revealing essays, and to show the people today how much the government does not want you to read about Samuel Bryan, his 24 essays, which are about 212 pages long, are available at Amazon for $900.
Wow, what a quotation. I have never run across that in my own studies and research. In fact, Michael, I would like you first, I'd like to first note if you could send me that quote and
yes, sir.
It's the documentation for it.
Yes, sir.
That's a quote I'm going to put into use. In fact, I'd like you to say it again.
He said that the Constitution itself was a criminal conspiracy. And then there's a couple of sentences in between, but he indicated that the Federalists would wrap their Constitution in the cloaks of divinity.
Boy, you know, that's the last part of that that really struck me, because not only was that fulfilled with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, but that is that is being fulfilled today in such an incredible way by today, ironically, by today's Christian pastors and leaders who are just determined to make the Constitution a biblical document, when in fact it's anything but that. So it's been wrapped in this what was the term wrapped in?
The cloak of divinity.
Cloak of divinity. Golly, is that ever still being fulfilled today? And men, I think who I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, who have good intentions, but who are doing more harm to this nation than they could even fathom that they're doing by promoting this document as being biblically compatible, and they've led many people astray.
All right, there's the music for the break, sir. We'll be back at the top of the hour. Thanks, everyone. Join us, please, on the top of the on the flip side.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to our program today, a combination of Dare to Think Out Loud and Addicted to Your Own Destruction. And we have been certainly graced with the presence of Parson Ted Weiland and talking about, is the Constitution a Christian document? And this has just been, you know, I believe that we could probably talk about this subject for a day and a half, Parson, and not cover everything I would like to. But are you familiar with the what was referred to as the Committee of Style at the Constitutional Convention?
Yeah, to some degree.
All right. Are you familiar with the gentleman by the name of Gouverneur Morris?
Yes.
Are you? There is a document that has been filed with the U.S. Supreme Court that indicates that the Committee of Style, in fact, altered the Constitution and even put things back in it that the Committee of the Whole had said had voted down and were replaced by this Committee of Style. And it is quite a revealing document. I was kind of surprised that it's actually made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I don't see them doing anything with it whatsoever. But it is it's pretty doggone effective, and it's got a lot of documentation to prove it. And it also indicates that the preamble to the Constitution, that part which changed the sovereign of the country, from the documents you read earlier on, I believe, from Connecticut, it changed the sovereign from, you know, our God to we the people. And that was the pre-entirely Gouverneur Morris. Have you studied, or do you have comments on that point, sir?
Just to let you know, you were cutting out there at the very end a little bit off and on. I was still able to pick up what you were asking, but in case there's something that needs to be corrected. I'm not real familiar with the material you said. Of course, chapter 3 of Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, the Christian perspective. And again, for anyone who's joined us for this second hour who wasn't there in the first hour, you can find the entire 575-page book at Bible Versus, that's Versus spelled out, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution.org, BibleVersusConstitution.org. Go to our online book and article page, and actually the very top entry is that book. You click on that, and then you'll get individual chapters all the way through. My book, for those who have just joined us, my book provides a chapter where I examine the Constitution, every article and every amendment of the Constitution by the Bible. And you can also take our 10-question Constitution survey in the right-hand sidebar, and we'll provide you a free copy of the 85-page primer of the big book that we'll send to your address that you'll provide when you take the survey. By the way, Michael, I checked while we were on break there, and we've got, I'm sure, what our people getting the who have taken the survey, and I'll be sending primers to from the first hour. I'm sure they're probably coming from our program this morning.
Fantastic.
Amen.
That's wonderful news, sir. I appreciate that. And I kind of jumped ship here because I had mentioned before we came to the second hour, would you address the Bill of Rights and how you saw the Bill of Rights? And of course, we've talked about the First Amendment, and people think the First Amendment was a great thing, but it opened the door for every dissenting viewpoint to the to our Christian faith. So would you go into the Bill of Rights as you see them, sir, from a Christian perspective?
Well, I do the same with the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments and the following amendments as well, in the same fashion that I do with the articles of the Constitution itself, in the book, Bible Law versus United States Constitution. So there's a chapter devoted to every article and every amendment, examining them by the Bible. So they'll find individually each how I deal with each of the 10 amendments of the Bill of Rights therein in their respective chapters in the book. As I pointed out in the first hour, and I'd like to repeat it, and that is that the one component of the Constitution and Bill of Rights that probably Christians hang their hat on more than any other component of the two is the First Amendment. And it's, in fact, one of the most biblically seditious components of the entire Constitution, along with the preamble and Article 6 Christian test ban, by which mandatory biblical qualifications were also eliminated for civil leaders. Those three are, and of course, they'll find those chapters as well as the Second Amendment and some others dealt with in the primer. I took what I felt, of course, what was most important and condensed those chapters and put them in the primer. So I hope more people will be taking the survey so they can get this primer and we can get them started down the right road as it concerns the biblical compatibility of the Constitution, which there is none. It's not biblical at all. I would also like to quickly point out that you'll also find a recent debate I did with constitutional attorney Brent Winters, and I wouldn't be surprised that that's a name some of your listeners are familiar with. Last year, he and I had a three-hour debate on the question, is the Constitution biblically compatible? You'll find that also on our website. And then I recently did a interview similar to this one with Coach Dave Dobenmeyer, that's now available as well on our video page. So I hope people will take advantage of that. Again, everything on our coming from this ministry is free of charge. Of course, we live on donations, making it run. But I'm not interested in building my empire. I'm interested in advancing the kingdom of God. And I'm never going to let money stand in the way of that. So all of my books are online free of charge. And you can also, if you can't afford you want a hardback of my books, I've written over 24, I believe it's now, books. If you can't afford a donation, that's fine. You let me know and I will send it to you, whatever you want, free of charge, provided you will use it or use it for somebody else. Now, all of that said, back to your question. As far as the Bill of Rights, I deal with all of those from a biblical standpoint in their individual chapters in the big book. Second Amendment, for example, people say, well, that's got to be biblical. Well, it's close to being biblical, but the problem is that the constitutional framers threw out what was potent for something that was basically impotent. And if you don't think it's impotent, I want you to think about this. The amendment with the wording "shall not be infringed" is the most infringed, licensed, and limited of all of the amendments and the rest of the Constitution. I ask people, which is more potent? A non-optional responsibility, as found in the Bible when it comes to protecting ourselves, our families, and others by any means available to us at the time, whether it be by a firearm or any other means, which is more potent? A non-optional biblical responsibility. According to 1 Timothy 5:8, we're worse than infidels if we don't provide for our families. And that begins with spiritual and physical protection. So which is more potent? A non-optional biblical responsibility based upon God's word and his laws, or a non-optional enlightenment right, such as the Second Amendment? America was basically sold down the river when those framers, Enlightenment guys and Freemasons for the most part, replaced the biblical responsibilities of God's word for Enlightenment rights. I like to also ask the question too, what was the authority of the pre-Second Amendment Americans? They didn't need the Second Amendment to provide them a right to bear arms. So what was their authority? Well, for the majority of them, it was Psalms 149, I believe it's 6 through 11, and 1 Timothy 5:8, and other passages. And with basically little or no infringement whatsoever. They didn't need the Second Amendment, and we don't either, because we've been given the authority by God's word and a non-optional responsibility to take care of ourselves, our families, and others by any means possible. So the Second Amendment, that's part of how I deal with the Second Amendment in chapter 12 of the big book. And also partially in the primer as well, and to show that it's one of the what you could say is possibly the more biblical of the components, but they threw away what was potent for what was impotent, and anybody should be able to see that, because there's no question that the very amendment with the wording "shall not be infringed" is the most infringed. That's because it's an optional right. Under the Bible, it's a non-optional responsibility. Again, 1 Timothy 5:8, you're worse than an infidel if, as a Christian, you don't provide protection for your family and, of course, everything else that comes with being the provider of your family. Whereas under the Constitution and the Second Amendment, it's your optional right if you want to do so. If you want to bear arms to protect your family, it's your right. It's not your responsibility to do so. So again, it should be clear that even though the Second Amendment is more biblically attuned than many other parts of the Constitution, it's still not anything near what we find in God's Word and His law.
Well, Parson, that is an excellent response, especially on the Second Amendment. And I don't want to hog all the time here. We've got DW who's been sitting quietly in the background, and maybe even Dave or Cal might have a question for you. I don't want to prevent them from having that. But one thing that I would like to address before we go to that, and that would be an amendment that the Supreme Court just absolutely will not approach. And that's the Ninth Amendment. How do you see the Ninth Amendment as perhaps guaranteeing the people the rights of our Creator?
All right. Well, I deal with the Ninth Amendment in Chapter 18. That chapter is entitled Amendment 9, Rights versus Righteousness. And note, the word righteousness begins with the word right. Rights versus righteousness. In that chapter, let me get to it here, a book that some of your people may recognize, in a book entitled Understanding the Constitution, 10 Things Every Christian Should Know About the Supreme Law of the Land, David Gibbs Jr. and David Gibbs III argue for unalienable rights. Here's part of what they have in the book. Quote, our rights come from God. How often do you hear that? We probably should discuss that one phrase alone at some point here if we have time. But again, they say, so often parroted, but in fact, not at all true. It says, our rights come from God, not from the state. Therefore, the state cannot take them away. What Uncle Sam gives, Uncle Sam can take away. But our nation's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence, makes it clear that our rights are unalienable because they come from God. End of quote. My first, let me put this out here first, and that is, what God? Because the Declaration was principally authored by Antichrist Thomas Jefferson. And if you go to 2 John 7-11, and if you understand anything about Thomas Jefferson's position on Christ, you'll recognize that he was an Antichrist according to the definition provided by the Apostle John in 2 John 1:7-11. And by the way, John never describes a singular Antichrist. It's a plurality of men who reject Christ that he's describing there that were in existence at the time that John wrote his epistles. He's the only one that uses the term, and he's therefore the only one that can define the term. And regrettably, it's been hijacked by a lot of eschatologically wrong Christians today. That aside, the God that's referred to here is not the God of the Bible. It's the generic God and creator, that of the Declaration of Independence, of Antichrist Thomas Jefferson. So even if it was provided by a God, it's not the God of the Bible that provided those rights. Now, I go on to say, let me read the next paragraph. I said, this sounds wonderful. You know, wow, the state can take, if the state can provide them, the state can take them away. What Uncle Sam gives, Uncle Sam can take away. Well, that sounds wonderful, but is it true? The state has certainly taken away an unwanted infant's right to life. Alleged right to life. I don't believe there is an alleged right to life except for the Creator. But let's just go with that. The state has certainly taken away an unwanted infant's right to life. The state has incrementally taken away gun owners' Second Amendment, I'm going to put in alleged rights. The state has taken away the right to happiness, in particular, the right to own property. By the way, is there any private property today in America?
No,
there is not one square inch of private property left in America. Why? Because of Amendment 5's provision for government confiscation, that's called THEFT, of private property by means of eminent domain, property taxes, and public lands. And if you don't believe that your property is owned by the state, both whether state or government or federal government, just stop paying your property taxes. And agents wearing badges the ages representing the real owners with badges and sidearms will come at some point and escort you off the land that belongs to them. They're the ones who have sent them, and give them enough guff and they'll escort you to jail. So there's no private property. So what this whole argument, and again, you hear Christians parrot this all the time, that, you know, if these rights don't come from God. If they came from, if they come from the state can take them away. Well, what do you think they've been doing for 233 years? Because rights come from the state can take them away at its pleasure and has done so. On the other hand, as pointed out in chapter 11 of my book, which deals with Amendment 1, Yahweh's law does not recognize rights whatsoever, God-given or otherwise, but only God-required responsibilities. Can I go on with this whole idea about rights?
Please, sir.
Okay, I've got three articles. I'll only mention two of them that are on our blog, which also is obviously available at BibleVersusConstitution.org. If you go to our blog and search on the title "Rights: Man's Sacrilegious Claim to Divinity." Listen. The whole idea of rights that so many Christians and patriots are caught up on and trying to defend and trying to retain and trying to gain back is an entirely non-biblical Enlightenment concept for the purpose of making man his own sovereign in violation of 1 Timothy 6:15, etc. The only one with a right to anything, I want you to think about this. The only one with a right to anything is our God and Creator. Even life is not a right except to God. It's inherent in Him as Creator. He's got a right to life. For the rest of us, life is a gift from and a responsibility to the one who created us. That's inherent in us as the created. It's a gift from the only one who has a right to life and therefore can provide life to others. And it's a responsibility to deal with that life as God intends for us to deal with it. If life and everything that comes with it is our right, then God, think about this, then God was obligated to create us, making Him subservient to us. And therefore, without the authority to judge us for what's our right to do with as we please. And that goes for all of the other rights of the Ten Amendments or any others that they might want to come up with in Article 9 or Article 10. All of them are bogus, created by these Enlightenment Masonic theistic rationalists known as constitutional framers and founding fathers. And it's a sacrilegious claim of being God, exactly what the framers had in mind with the sovereignty of man. They wanted man sovereign. They did not want God as sovereign. And in either chapter 3 or chapter 4 of the book, I provide quotations from those guys, Adams and Madison, and some others, showing that what they were promoting the sovereignty of man, not the sovereignty of God, and thereby they were making man his own sovereign and therefore his own God. So that's also available in the book.
Great job, Parson. Absolutely fantastic. Let me have some other folks have some questions here. DW, do you have some questions, sir?
Before DW comes on, could you do me a favor?
Yes, sir.
Could you explain? I mean, people are going to be calling me Parson from here on out. Not that I mind it, especially in light of why you are calling me that. It's not a term that I use. By the way, I never use the term reverend. There's only one time in the Bible where reverend is used, and it's only in reverence to God, the only one who deserves to be called reverend. But I do call myself pastor, and I don't call myself parson. Would you mind telling the audience why you're using the word parson, which I appreciate very much?
I don't mind at all, sir. As a matter of fact, I'd be proud to tell them. I was had a very great influence in my life, which was my grandfather, and a man that I learned very early on, there were no gray in his life. Everything was black and white. He lived to be 100 years old, spent the last 5 years of his life actually living with me, and died at the age of 100. And he was pretty critical, especially of preachers. And we would go to church together, and he would dissect what we had heard on several occasions. And at one point in time, he told me, he said, boy, there's a lot of preachers out there. There are very few parsons. So in his world, as I mentioned earlier, a parson was the creme de la creme of the people in the ministry. And having read Mr. Weiland's book and having watched the debates and the discussion with Dave Dobenmeyer and those others, I feel in my mind that the Parson Weiland has more than deserved that moniker.
Well, I don't deserve it. You know, again, let me say that anything good you see in Ted Weiland, it's Christ. And so he gets the glory, praise, and honor. But I do appreciate that. And I just thought people would need to know why you use the word parson. And I appreciate that. And I think I fell in love with your grandpa.
Well, I know I very much, and he was quite, you would have liked him, sir, I promise. DW, you want to jump in here and ask some questions?
Well, sure. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I just want to say, Parson Ted, that, I just want to thank you for taking us all to church and school at the same time. And your schooling here is allowing for the ears to hear how to reconcile the contradictions, and so often we just we're stuck with people that need to interpret the events of the world and the scripture to a bias that supports how they want their belief system to be versus what it is supposed to be. And there's just so much to unpack in the first hour and a half of this that I'm sort of overwhelmed. It doesn't happen often, but I am a bit overwhelmed. As I was listening to you and Michael talk, it came to occur to me that, well, several questions. They're both a bit rhetorical, but it's the lament of what I hear you and Michael addressing and talking to is the first rhetorical question is, how can an illiterate peoples come to literate conclusions?
And good question.
The spinoff of that is the direct question is, can you reach an accurate decision based upon a false premise? And if, since this is in fact the observable facts, as well as we're proving in the conversation today, you and Michael are both proving as to the basis of what the facts are, then there's only one way for this to be reconciled, and it's simply through repentance. Whoever hears this, you have to repent, and you have a stiff neck. And I don't know. I have a lot of observations. I don't really know as I have any real questions. I could say this, and I know that Cal's on here and Dave as well, and I want to leave some time here. But if I don't get any more opportunity here going forward in the next half hour, would you genuinely and truly heartfelt question for me and request, would you really consider coming back and spending more time with us in the future?
Lord willing, yeah, you bet. You know, we can deal with that at a later time and work something out. But yeah, as you know, Daryl, you're the one who first contacted me about doing this and had me listen to one of the programs. And you know that I was a little bit hesitant based on the program, at least the part that I listened to, in that I don't believe the answer is, obviously, I don't believe the answer is in the federal constitution. And in fact, I'll go so far as to say I believe it's the worst thing that ever happened to America. There is not a problem in America today that cannot be traced back to that document, either to the sins of commission of the framers, which is found in every article and amendment and anywhere where it's antithetical or seditious to God's sovereignty and his morality. And there's hardly an article that isn't in numerous different ways, but also even to their sins of omission by the very fact that they did not create a government based upon God's immutable, unchanging moral laws. That alone has sent us to the precipice of moral depravity and destruction. And let me give you an example. People are rightfully concerned with what's normally called abortion. I don't call it that. I think that's the wrong terminology. And I think Roe versus Wade was won over that terminology at all. And even before it got to the courtroom, and it would never have gotten to the courtroom had it instead been addressing in utero infanticide, because that's what it is. Abortion, you know, even a term baby is an abortion. The baby is aborted from its mother's womb in a natural fashion. And many times they've won the war against us on terminology alone. And abortion is one of those. We need to call it for what it really is, in utero infanticide. We need to quit calling them gays. They're sodomites. You know, here's something interesting. You know, you'll hear Christians often say, well, I don't agree with their lifestyle, but I've got friends who are gay. Well, when's the last time you said, well, I've got friends who are sodomites? Or lesbians. They'll never say it that way, which illustrates the fact that our terminology is important. But back to my point on their sins of omission, had the Constitution framers, like their early 1600 predecessors, like in that document from New Haven, Connecticut I read to you, expressly established today their government and today's government on God's law, including Exodus 20:13, 22:12 through 13, and Deuteronomy 27 and 25, and others, all of which deal with murder and also infanticide, and paying these infanticide doctors to do what they do. That's what those three passages deal with. Had they not omitted that, and had they actually established a government on God's law, including just those three passages, Roe versus Wade would have never been heard of, Planned Parenthood wouldn't exist, and millions of infants slaughtered in their mother's womb, financed by the Constitutional Republic, would have lived to see the light of day. And there is not an issue today in America, an abomination today in America, whether it be sodomite, quote unquote, marriages, whether it be infanticide, whether it be the economy, you name it, that cannot be traced back to the framers' sins of omission alone, let aside their sins of commission as found in the Constitution itself. So, you know, people will say, well, why are you so caught up with the Constitution? Well, because it's our national idol. And like Gideon's father's idol, it has to be torn down for us ever to make significant progress in reestablishing his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. You know, there's nowhere in heaven where God is not sovereign, and there is nowhere in heaven where his morality, as reflected here on earth in his commandments, statutes, and judgments where his law is not supreme. We've got a lot of work to do. We're to be advancing his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven, per Matthew 6, 10, and 33, as it is in heaven. We've got a long ways to go. And what's standing in the way more than anything else is Christian and patriot belief in the Constitution as the supreme law of the land. It is our national idol, and therefore it needs to come down. My purpose is not to simply tear down the Constitution. It's to reestablish Yahweh, God of the Bible, as sovereign over America, like he was in the early 1600s, and his law is supreme. That was the reason America became great, according to Deuteronomy 4, 5, and 8, Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, Psalms 19, 7 through 11, etc. And for anybody who thinks that God's law is no longer pertinent under the New Testament, like I did, you've been bamboozled. Now, it's not our means of justification, forgiveness, salvation, eternal life. That's all exclusively through the blood atoning sacrifice and resurrection of Christ. But Christ, when he died, did not eliminate his father's morality, God forbid, as found or codified or reflected in his commandments, statutes, and judgments, which is the standard for by which, as Christians over society, God intends for us to conduct our lives. And therefore, my emphasis is that not just tearing down the Constitution, but it's like Gideon with his father's idol, tearing down the idols that stand in the way of progressing with God as our sovereign and his kingdom once again. His kingdom as reflected in a government of, by, and for God, established exclusively upon his law and governed exclusively by biblically qualified men of God. You know, people ought to ask the question, how did we end up with such people like we've got today? Well, it's because by their sins of omission alone, they didn't require God's mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders. Then they turned around and with their sins of commission, they eliminated or banned Christian tests and thereby biblical qualifications for civil leaders. No one, if they had established biblical qualifications, no one would have ever heard of Biden, Harris, Clintons, Obama, Pelosi. They would never have heard of them, let alone had to suffer under their legislation. And the same for the other caliber of swamp crocodiles known as elephants, disguised as elephants. They're just two different species of swamp crocodiles disguised as donkeys and elephants. Nobody would have heard of any of them, but we'd instead had men like Ezra and Moses and men who were biblically qualified, who feared God, along with all of the other biblical qualifications provided in his law that are mandatory for civil leaders. So I appreciate what you were saying there, Daryl, and I was really hoping to get to that point that you stimulated there, that the emphasis is not the Constitution, it's God as sovereign and his law. And of course, Christ is as savior of the remnant, which we know is always going to be a limited number of people. But God intends that limited number to have dominion over the rest of society. And it's not only good for Christians, it's good for non-Christians too. There's no better society than under God's law.
All right. Well, my complaint, what I've observed and learned once I got rid of my stiff neck, was that I observed that the Constitution, the people giving consent to the Constitution, gives that and those people that exercise it the license of being apostate. It licensed the apostate so that they may ascend to apotheosis. They transform themselves into law makers and lawgivers.
Well said.
It establishes this prostitution of the Constitution. Nay, the Constitution lays the foundation for regal precedence of the presidents. We're living in real time in a visceral manner, the evidence in a daily struggle. We're living in the evidence, not just talking about history. We're living it, the evidence of the efficacy of the intent of that apostate. And
Hosea's whirlwind.
Yeah. And so I could say more. I'm going to defer and open the table to Cal or Dave. And thank you so much, Parson Ted.
Yeah, if I could, before they come on, because that stimulated something else that I'd like to point out, and that is that there's so much emphasis, of course, especially here lately with the election being quote unquote robbed from Trump, and it probably was. But there's so much emphasis on the vote of the people, one man, one vote, and election. Well, what people don't realize is one of the stupidest things that the constitutional framers ever did was to usurp Yahweh's exclusive election authority as found in Deuteronomy 17, 15, and et cetera. One God, one vote, election system. One of the dumbest things that the constitutional framers did was to, and this is all for the sovereignty of man once again, was to usurp Yahweh's exclusive election authority and turn it over to we the people, to we the people's quote unquote discretion, the majority of whom are, according to Christ in Matthew 7:13, are found in the Broadway leading to destruction. Now, where do you think the Broadway destruction bunch is going to take America? How about to the precipice of destruction, right where America finds herself today? God never intended man, fickle, finite man, to vote for anybody. That's his exclusive authority. Read Deuteronomy 17:15. You'll find it there and in other places. And I've got on our blog site, also available at, or that you can access through BibleVersusConstitution.org. If you will search on the title, Constitutional Elections, Dining at the Devil's Table, you'll find I expand on this issue quite a well. And then in a follow-up blog by the title of Salvation by Election, don't be fooled by the title, it deals with election, you'll find an explanation on how the Bible's one God, one vote election system operates. A system, by the way, by which you end up with the best of the best of two or more biblically qualified candidates every single time. Whereas under the constitutional election system, under we the people, the majority of whom are in the Broadway leading to destruction, at the very best, you end up with the lesser of two evils. Sometimes, though, you end up with the worst of the worst. And always, always, the evil of two lessers. So take your choice, people. You know, you want to be promoting the system that's the best you can get out of it, or do you want a system that provides through God's election, one God, one vote election system, the means to have a biblically qualified candidate every single time? And principally, the only thing that's needed are judges who are adjudicating his commandments, statutes, and judgments over local ecclesias or local bodies or communities of people that are being governed by God's law. So let's go to the other guys.
Well, Ted, you know, I would just like to thank you for coming on the show as well. And
who am I talking to first?
This is Dave.
Hey, Dave. Yeah, I thought it was.
And I would just like to thank you for coming on the show. And I do hope that you can come back, because you've really opened my eyes up to something that I've really never understood. I have to admit my ignorance on this, the kind of society that could be shaped by purely by molding it to God's laws. And I would really love you to come back and, you know, expound upon what such a society would look like and how it would be formed and constructed and lived. Because, you know, we really are living the fruits of this, this system that was set up through the Constitution. And we are in an absolutely dire situation. For anyone that has eyes to see, we are in the most dire situation imaginable. And we're living the fruits of this toxic system that was set up. And I just thought your whole discourse has been absolutely amazing. And I want to thank you for it.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And yeah, we can certainly do this another time, Lord willing. Let me first point out, for the dire situation that we're in right now, I have a favorite saying, and that it's everything goes wrong, just right. What we're really experiencing, we need, you know, is God is sovereign, and he is, what we're experiencing right now is his judgment. And you go through the Bible, and it's his, he uses his judgment time and time and time and time again, so that, and it often says this very statement, it says, so that you will know that I am Yahweh. And obviously, all this in the great I am, the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end of all things, all that's included in who he is. He uses judgment. Boy, we are being judged. And I think it's only going to get much worse before our people are actually going to respond correctly to that. Although there are many who are. I'll tell you what we've been going through the last, especially this last year, I'm getting more attention than I have in a long time. The website is not me personally, of course, but God's law and God is sovereign, the whole idea. And so in one sense, it's going to be tough. I tell people, you know, we who are the remnant in Christ, we need to be praying Habakkuk's prayer found in Habakkuk 3:1, where he said, O Lord, in wrath, remember mercy. And he's a merciful God. He will provide the mercy where we need. But that doesn't mean that we don't have some tough time to go. As a part of this nation who's in rebellion to their God, it's gotten tougher, and it's only going to get much tougher until our people repent. So, but it puts a whole different perspective on it if you say that everything goes wrong, just right. God is sovereign, and he's doing his work, and we're watching. This is an incredible time to live. We're at the very beginning of what is probably the most important paradigm shift in America, in America's history. Even more important than when the Puritans came over here to establish governments of, by, and for God. We get to witness the tearing down of the governments of, by, and for the people, and start seeing it replaced with another government of, by, and for God. And things are happening so quickly. It was things that I've never thought I'd see in my lifetime. And we're making headway. It may be slow right now, but it's going to speed up. Everything speeds up with God's judgment. Now, back to another point, and that is that if you had mentioned, Dave, how this has opened your eyes to what society actually can be. And I would add what society actually was. If people think that what I'm describing is just impossible, you know, they need to consider that what I'm describing already took place here in America at an earlier time in the early 1600s. They had it back then. Regrettably, they lost it. Man, in his fickle, finite, you know, ways, tends to blow things up. But it's already happened here in America. And a lot of people, there's a quote that goes around from Alexis de Tocqueville that I had used in the past, but when I finally tried to document it, it's where if you're going to find the greatness of America, you need to go to their churches and the preaching from the pulpit. Unless somebody can come up with it, Alexis de Tocqueville never said that. Now, he made general statements that probably somebody had kind of accumulated and made it look like a quote, and that quote has gone all over the countryside, as if Alexis de Tocqueville actually wrote that. He didn't. I can't tell you how much work I did to try to document that quote, and you just can't find it. And what's ironic is that what he did say, you never hear anybody quote. This is also in chapter 3 of Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, the Christian Perspective. And it's a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy and in America, 1835. You punch the footnote and or the end note, and it'll take you to the footnote that actually documents this quote. And here's what he said. And listen carefully, because this is very important. He says they exercised, talking about the Puritans in the 1600s, he says they exercised the rights of sovereignty. They named their magistrates, concluded peace. Now, this goes right back to, by the way, New Haven, Connecticut's constitution, part of which I read in the previous hour. He's referring, I think, specifically to that document. And he says, they exercised the rights of sovereignty, they named their magistrates, concluded peace or declared war, made police regulations and enacted laws as if their allegiance was due only to God. Nothing can be, now here's where it really gets important, nothing can be more curious and at the same time more instructive than the legislation of that period. It is there that the solution of the great social problems which the United States now presents to the world is to be found, not just in the churches. In fact, in today's churches, you're not going to find it at all. Most of them don't even believe in God's law. He wasn't saying back to the churches in the pulpits. He was saying, you got to go back to the legislation, which was God's law. And he says, amongst these documents, we shall notice, and here it is, as especially characteristic, the code of laws promulgated by the little state of Connecticut, and he doesn't go back as far as I did, but to 1650. The legislators of Connecticut begin with the penal laws, and they borrow their provisions from the text of Holy Writ. And it quotes then, he says, he goes on to quote the New American Standard, says the preamble, or excuse me, New American Standard. He quotes the First Commandment as a part of its preamble, and its judgment of death. Anyway, he goes on from there, and they can find that in chapter 3. So it's already happened here, Dave. It's not like it's impossible. Nothing's impossible with our God. If we'll only be obedient to him, he can make this happen all over again, and we can turn our nation back to the prosperous, peaceful, godly nation that it once was at a prior state when it first began, when things first began under the Puritans here in early 1600s America. But first, we got to tear down this idol or we're never going to get there.
Parsons? What? This is Cal.
Yes, Cal.
First, I want to thank you. I've been totally enthralled with this show, and I sincerely hope you can come back and join us again. Same group, you know, with the Gaddy Gang, as I guess we're being called now. I have a question for you, and the question is man's free will part of God's law?
Well, God certainly gives us the right to disobey him or not to disobey him. And that's an interesting question, Cal, from the standpoint that I often get that with some of my responses to the blogs that I often address every day. And they say, you know, we've got to allow man the free will to disobey God. And okay, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't also have consequences for when you do so. But what's different about that and what they use that argument for is that whereas, you can disobey God if you want to, Cal, or I can, or Michael can, or any of us can. But that is a different situation totally from a government enabling, for example, religions promoting gods, not Yahweh, God of the Bible, to proliferate through the land. Yeah, as an individual, I certainly have a right, but you can't turn that around and say then that it's then the right of governments to make that more likely or more possible. When you do that, that government is violating the First Commandment. And unless you believe that God doesn't care anymore about the First Commandment and that he is God and the only God, then people should have a real big problem with what they did with the First Amendment. And that's just an example of how what you said is often, I'm not saying you're using it in that fashion, but that's how it's often used as if the constitutional framers did right by enabling these other religions to take root here in America and proselyte our posterity to their false gods.
Hey guys, we've got, hold on just a second, Cal. We've got just about 3 minutes left to go. Cal, if you will finish with your question, and let's give Parson Ted a chance to close us out, please.
I was just going to comment to the parson that I actually see government as antithetical to people's free will, to that gift God gave all of us of our free will. I see that government is actually antithetical, is anti-God, so to speak, because being governed by others and not by God removes God as your governor, so to speak.
Yeah.
That's what I had.
Okay.
So, thank you, Parsons.
Yeah, excellent point. I took it somewhere else, but so I'm glad you clarified on that, because that's an excellent point. The question is, do we want to be ruled by a merciful God, or do we want to be ruled instead by fickle, finite men who inevitably take us to the precipice of moral depravity and destruction? And that's what was created by the constitutional framers with the biblically seditious constitution they provided. That if I've got to drive anything home to your audience, and that is that you've been lied to if you believe that the Constitution is in any fashion biblically compatible. It is the exact opposite. It is as biblically incompatible as it possibly can be, and it's the reason America finds itself in the mess it is today. We are reaping Hosea 8's whirlwind. In Hosea 8:1, he says, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Then you jump down to verse 7. He says, for they have sown the wind. That's what the constitutional framers did. And they shall reap the whirlwind. We're reaping the whirlwind of the wind sown by the constitutional framers. Everything, either to their sins of commission or omission, can be traced back to what the constitutional framers did when they rejected Yahweh as sovereign over America and his law as supreme. As society standard. Let me, if I could, I'll just mention again the website. It's BibleVersusConstitution.org, versus spelled out, Bible, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution.org. And again, for anybody who joined us late, if they'll go to the sidebar, they can take our 10-question Constitution survey. And once they do and fill it out, I will then send them a free copy of the 85-page primer of the big book, Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective. The emphasis here is on God is sovereign and his law is supreme, not just in tearing down the idol, but the idol has to be torn down if we're ever going to get to where we really want to go in America.
Well, Parson Ted, we appreciate you, sir. Thanks so much for coming on. Everyone, please... tune in next week, and we hope to have Parson Ted back with us at his convenience. Thanks so very much, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
alert, alert, listen up now.
Tune into the Two Corner with Metro Zero XE
05173.
We talk about decentralization.